Dr. Elaine Schroeder. Welcome to Mind Over Matter. Tonight, we're going to talk about an inevitable life event, death. Many people say they do not fear death, but rather they feel anxious about possible pain and incapacitation as their life ends. And with Americans living longer, but often with painful and debilitating diseases, many people fear that their last months of life will be a nightmare. In response to public pressure, several U.S. states have enacted legislation that allows physician-assisted deaths for terminally ill patients. We might wonder, what is a good death? What would you want for your own dying process? A new bill has been introduced in the Alaska legislature. It reopens the debate on death with dignity in Alaska. And this legislation would allow terminally ill patients to request a lethal prescription to end their life. Tonight, I have invited State Representative Harriet Drummond and her aide, Kristen Crandon-Dunk, to our show. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you, Elaine. It's delightful to be here.
Okay, great. I'd like to begin by asking you, Representative Drummond, who I will now call Harriet, how did you become interested in end-of-life issues and introducing this Death with Dignity legislation?
Interestingly, I didn't have a personal stake in the game. My own mother is 92 years old, so I have lots of time to look forward to personally, and I don't have anybody close to me who has suffered and died in a difficult way recently. But I was very touched by the story of Brittany Maynard, a California woman, 29 years old with brain cancer, who came into the national spotlight in 2014. She was able to move to Oregon in order to take advantage of the Death with Dignity laws. She deteriorated rapidly and was really suffering and knew that the end was going to be very difficult. But she had the ability to move and take her husband with her. She was a newlywed. It was a very tragic case, but death was swift, certain, and there was no cure. And she knew that she wanted to be in control of her dying. And she got to move to California. She moved from California to Oregon, right next door, in order to take advantage of their death with dignity laws. And she died in the way that she wanted, in control of her dying. But we in Alaska have hundreds of miles to travel, thousands of miles to travel to take advantage of death with dignity laws. And it, you know, to limit this option to people with wealth is it's simply not fair. So many people are dying in the hospital these days. Until World War II, the majority of people died at home.
Yeah.
And now it's the other way around. And most people die in the hospital or in hospice care or long-term care. I just want Alaskans to have choices.
Yeah, so it's all about choices.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that I understand, because I was well aware of Brittany Maynard's situation because it was in the news a lot, and in fact I was one of the probably millions of people that listened to her YouTube video and was really moved by it. And so were so many others, because apparently Maynard's death really galvanized the thinking around the right for people to choose, if they have a terminal illness, whether or not they could ask their physician to prescribe medication. And apparently in California, this caused a change of heart in the state legislature. Mm-hmm. And the state polls after Brittany Maynard's demise were 71% for a death with dignity legislation compared to 22% against. And I think that soon after California, during a special session, as I understand it, happened, Governor Brown called a special session around Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
And so at that session, the Death with Dignity legislation was discussed. and passed by the state legislature.
Right.
And one thing I noticed, I was looking at some data, and after Brittany Maynard's case grabbed the headlines, support for assisted death for terminal patients really grew. And here's what's interesting, and I think that this really speaks to your legislation and the possibility that it will get passed sometime and not too far away. After her death and the news around it, people 18 to 34, 19% increase in their approval of such legislation. 80% of individuals 18 to 34 now approve. So young people approve. And I think one of the reasons is that they could really identify with Brittany Maynard. Because otherwise you're thinking, hey, I can't even think about that. That's so far away. But this was a case where she was their age. And they thought, oh, my gosh, what if that could happen to me? And then the number it goes down. So people who are 35 to 54 years old, a little bit, about an 8% increase after Brittany Maynard's death, up to about, it looks like, I'd say 68%. So right now, 68%. 55 and older, about 60% approval of legislation. Around Republicans, 62% approval. Democrats, 80%. Oh, independents, 80% approval. And Democrats, I'm looking at a graph, so I'm going to estimate 72% approval. Mm-hmm. So the approval ratings, I wonder if anybody's done any research in Alaska on what Alaskans think.
We have not done a poll, but shortly before we came down here for the legislative session, I participated in a debate held by the UAA debate team at the Beartooth Theater in Anchorage, which sold out. After the debate, they took a cell phone text poll after the debate, and 63% of those present, and there, I want to say that theater probably seats about 300 people. 63% were in favor of this legislation after the debate. So that reflects the national numbers. And there were all kinds of people there, close supporters, friends and family, and lots of students, because it was, of course, a UA debate team. And it was definitely a cross-section of Anchorage. Was
Did
present.
Any opponents show up, do you think?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Half of the other one debate team was in opposition. The other debate team was in support.
Mm-hmm. But they took those positions as an exercise. No. They did not.
Oh, no.
It wasn't UAA students who were debating.
No,
they sponsored
it.
There
That's
were
right.
real people.
Right. It's called the Arguing Alaska series.
Oh, okay.
And the debate teams, they do their own debating, you know, among colleges.
Okay.
But Arguing
That's
Alaska
right.
is a continuing program. They have argued, for example, on the anti-discrimination ordinance in Anchorage and other controversial issues. So this was
real.
This seemed like a good one. And the folks who are in the opposition team both called in to testify against my bill in the last spring when we had our first hearing.
Okay. Now tell me something about the legislation. Where did it come from? How did you write it up? What inspired you?
It's mostly based on the Oregon legislation, and we have been incorporating changes as things come to our attention. You know, the ages of people. In fact, I was looking at the document this afternoon, and I'm trying to figure out why we went to age 21 as being the cutoff of the lower end for somebody who might want to take advantage of this legislation. And, of course, at the other end, there is no limit. We tend to think of death and dying as elderly people or really sick people at the end of their
yeah.
life. They're older. So that's why it's interesting to hear the statistics on the younger people and their attitudes and how they changed. But in thinking about it, when you're 18 and even younger, you can register in the military and go off to die for your country.
Right.
I forget if cigarette smoking can start at 18 or 21, but you can do all these horrible things to yourself. You can drive a car at age 16, which is definitely a lethal weapon in some people's hands. And why should there be a limitation? You know, but we need to start this conversation. And what I'm finding is that it's healthy to talk about, and it makes people aware of what their options are or are not.
So tell us a little about the Oregon law, which this is my – or well, actually, tell us about the – Alaskan law, but it is modeled after the Oregon law. Is it exactly
the
same?
The Alaska law says that you have to be determined to be terminally ill, that your death is highly likely to happen within 6 months. You have to be assessed by two physicians who regularly work with the terminally ill, who can say this person. You know, they don't need to be consulting with one another, but separately they assess the person, the ill person. The sick person has to make the request for the medication. They have to be of sound mind at the time that they make the request. They don't necessarily have to be able to talk. They might be suffering with some condition that doesn't allow them to talk, but they have to make the request in writing or orally twice before receiving the prescription, approximately 2 weeks apart. And they have to do all of this in the presence of witnesses, and the witnesses cannot be the attending physicians, and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's to prevent coercion. They, at some point, they might want to visit with a psychologist or a psychiatrist to see if their issue is actually depression rather than actually an illness. It just opens up the conversation.
And then, as I understand it, there can be no underlying mental health issue. Isn't this a catch-22? So let's say somebody is in extreme pain from a terminal illness, has been deemed to probably die within 6 months, and they're very depressed because they've had this chronic illness or they've had cancer for a long time. Would that rule them out of being able to use this legislation, use this law?
I don't see why. Depression is treatable with counseling or with medication, and they should be able to come out of that depression in order to be able to be to be treated. And that brings up the subject of suicide. My opposition says you're encouraging suicide. Well, if a suicidal person wants to die, they're otherwise healthy, but they want to die. And if a suicidal person talks to a physician and says, "I want drugs to die," and the physician said, "No, you can't have them. You're perfectly. There's nothing wrong with you," but we assess you, and you are depressed or have otherwise another condition that can be assisted, and they don't need to die, then I think we've saved that person's life.
Mm-hmm.
So it is not in any way resembling the suicide epidemic that we have in this state, which is generally among young people in remote areas for vastly different reasons than
Absolutely.
For those who are terminally ill.
Right, and not to be confused.
Absolutely not to be
with
confused.
That. And I was looking up some information about the Oregon law and what's happened in the past, and I know you have some data too. What I read is that under the law, let's see, how many people do you have the data?
Yeah, we have the number.
Okay.
Yeah, we have the number.
In 2014, 155 people requested a prescription, a lethal prescription from their physician, and were approved. And I did also read that 5 out of 6 requests are rejected. Do you know anything about that?
I do not know about the rejection. What I can tell you is over the roughly 20-year existence of the law in Oregon, I would say as of 2013, approximately 1,200 Oregonians qualified for lethal prescriptions, and 752 used them to end their lives.
Mm-hmm.
That's a 35 to 40 a year over 20 years. The number has increased in the last couple of years to 1,700 total over 20 years. And I was just joking with Kristen, I wonder how many of those people migrated from California or other places
right.
to take advantage of it.
Oh, that's correct.
That's right. But now that California has passed this law, that's the most populous state in the nation.
Right.
The fact that they passed it approximately a year after Brittany took her own life means that they really paid attention. They
yeah.
stepped it up. And I think they had been fighting for this law to pass for 5 or 6 years. I don't expect this bill to pass quickly. This
mm-hmm.
is, you know, this, but this needs to open up the conversation about death and dying and the medical treatment in our state for people who are deathly ill. And it all is very relevant in the conversation about Medicaid expansion and the cost of medicine in Alaska.
I just have a feeling, since I was planning the show, I've been asking people I know briefly, would you approve or disapprove? And I'd say virtually 100%, that sounds like a funny figure, of people I know would approve because they said, at least it gives me an option. I don't know how I would feel when that time comes. I don't know if I would use it, but it gives me that option and it makes me feel at peace.
Exactly.
I do have the data from 2014 for Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
So I mentioned 155 people requested a prescription from their physician, and 105, only 105, utilized it in that 1 year, which turns out to be 1/3 of 1% of all the deaths in Oregon that year. So it's a very, very tiny amount. I'd like to share with you what happened with a friend of mine. A dear friend of mine who used to live here in Juneau, she had a stroke. She moved down to Seattle to be near her daughter, and she was 80. And she had a stroke. She was in very, very good health before that, very athletic. And she had a stroke, and she came back from the stroke pretty well, but she had what is output aphasia. She had a hard time expressing herself. And so I always went down to Seattle to see her, and especially after her stroke. So we had a long talk, and this is several months later, we met for lunch, and she asked me if I would be with her if she got the pills. And what she was, okay, I'm not going to say what, so I hemmed and hawed, and I never answered her. I did say, have you thought of asking your kids? She said they won't have a thing to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
So she had asked other people, but I was one of her closest friends.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically I never gave her an answer. And then about a year later, I get a telephone call from her daughter to say that she had taken her own life in another state and had contacted apparently one of the organizations that gives you information about this, and she had passed away. And I got thinking a lot about my friend, and what I believe she was afraid of is that she'd have another stroke and be incapacitated,
mm-hmm.
and she did not want to be a vegetable
mm-hmm.
in bed. She had talked obliquely about that, and I thought to myself, I wonder if she had lived in Oregon and had the possibility of having physician-assisted dying process
mm-hmm.
if she would have just stayed alive. But even in Oregon, that law probably would not have protected her
mm-hmm.
because if she had a stroke to the point where she was unable to communicate,
right.
she wouldn't be able to
right.
Use the law.
Right. Well, I thought of that too. You know, I mean, there are people with debilitating diseases that take a long time before they show any signs of total incapacitation and being in imminent death. But that's all part of this conversation. Right now, we're talking about people who are going to die within 6 months. They've got some awful condition that they're suffering, and they would much prefer to have a good quality of life at the end of life. I want to read a little bit from a really excellent book by Dr. Atul Gawande called Being Mortal. spending one's final days in an ICU or intensive care unit because of terminal illness is for most people a kind of failure. You lie attached to a ventilator, your every organ shutting down, your mind teetering on delirium and permanently beyond realizing that you will never leave this borrowed fluorescent place. The end comes with no chance for you to have said goodbye, or it's okay, or I'm sorry, or I love you. People with serious illness have priorities besides simply prolonging their lives. Surveys find their top concerns include avoiding suffering, strengthening relationships with family and friends, being mentally aware, not being a burden on others, and achieving a sense that their life is complete. Our system of technological medical care has utterly failed to meet these needs, and the cost of this failure is measured in far more than dollars. The question, therefore, is not how we can afford this system's expense. It's how we can build a healthcare system that will actually help people achieve what's most important to them at the end of their lives. People say, well, you know, the opposition says, once you have a right to die legislation in place, then it becomes a duty to die if you're costing too much. If, you know, in somebody's opinion, you're costing too much. But if you're totally out of it and you can't talk with your friends and loved ones about what you would like to have happen at the end of your life, then what satisfaction is there in that? You know, the people would much rather be lucid and able to spend time with their family and not worry about the agonies of dying. I'm going to read you a story that my friend Shannon Moore described. Years ago, I listened to the daughter of one prescription recipient in Oregon talk about the end of her mother's life. The mother had a very painful, drawn-out bout with cancer. It was difficult for the daughter to watch the body that had given her life so betray her mother. She said the surprising thing is that the day her mother got the prescription, she began to live again.
Ah, yes.
The little bottle in her house coat. And that brings memories. I remember my mother in her house coat, you know, the cotton dress
with the
pockets and the buttons down the front.
Yeah.
She began to live again. The little bottle in her house coat pocket gave her mother power over the pain.
Yes.
With every ache and spasm, her mother could decide for herself whether she was willing to endure more. She could stop it at any time. The end of pain was right there in her pocket. When the pain was particularly bad, she would reach in and squeeze the bottle until it passed. Her mother didn't end her own life. The cancer did that. But the daughter became an advocate for death with dignity because she saw not how it had given her mother death, but how it had given her life.
Well, you know, what you're touching on is a very basic thing of human psychology, and it is the sense of wanting to be in control. We want to have some sort of control, and I'll never forget when I was at the dentist one day, and the dentist said to me, look, we can avoid giving you Novocaine. This is not a really big deal. This isn't a big cavity, and if you'd prefer, you know, we can just do it without Novocaine. And I'm a wimp, so I just like went, oh, my God. I don't know if I can do it. And he says, here's the trick. If at any time you want me to stop drilling, raise your hand. And then I will immediately stop, and we can talk about whether you want Novocaine. Interesting, wasn't it? The parallel of squeezing the bottle in the pocket.
That's right.
So I made it all the way through. A couple of times I raised my hand, and then I said, no, keep going. And what is amazing is, when you know it's going to end, when you want it to end,
that's right.
It can allow you
to get
through a whole lot.
That's right. And the thing with us here in Alaska is there are people who are already taking their own lives because the end is near for them, and they have no other options. One of the most incredible testimonies we had last spring at our hearing was from Nancy Anna Clonin. She called in, and I've never heard anybody speak so fast in my life, but she told this story, and my heart just broke for her. Scott Meisner was her husband's name. He was a musician. He was an avid fisherman. He worked for an oil company. He loved his three sons and his wife. He was a smart man, a Mensa member, who liked to make his friends and family laugh. He made beautiful cabinetry in his woodshop. In March of 2010, with about a month left to live, Scott hung himself in his woodshop in Sterling. The last thing he did before he died was call the state troopers so his wife wouldn't have to find his body. When I first heard Nancy Anna Clonan talk about her husband, my heart broke for her. Scott lived with terminal melanoma for years before his death. As the cancer progressed, the symptoms worsened, debilitating migraines, vertigo, trouble breathing. The last thing Scott said to Nan before he took his own life was that, "I love you, and I promise that after today, everything will be okay." Of course, Nan didn't know Scott was planning to end his life, but she knew he was suffering, and they both knew he was going to die. He left letters for Nan and for each of his sons. He said, "My decision is not fear-based. It's my choice. Cancer killed me. I did not kill me." But Nan and her sons did not get to be with her husband when he died. She didn't get to say her final goodbye to him. Today, people are living longer than they ever have before. But the system we currently have means people like Scott are not given the choices they want when it comes to how they would like to die.
I want to say that all these stories add up, and you quoted Dr. Atul Gawande, and I have bought several copies of that book, coincidentally, to give out to my clients. And Dr. Atul Gawande is a professor of medicine at Harvard and a surgeon, and he's a beautiful writer, and he's written several books, actually, for consumers of medicine, you know, to really point out mistakes that are made. He's really on our side, and I'd highly recommend that book because one of the other points he makes is that with modern medicine, you know, the good news is we have a lot of new technological interventions to prolong life. The bad news is a lot of these interventions at the end of life can be more harmful than helpful. And they can create the nightmare I was talking about. And so what he is advising people in that book is to be very careful about what you wish for in terms of if you are at a more terminal stage of a particular of an illness, that the well, I'm going to quote him, the medicalization of mortality becomes most apparent at the very end of life, when the American health system spends billions of dollars on what Gawande calls the medical equivalent of lottery tickets, on aggressive and often futile interventions. And this echoes the other quote that you had. And, of course, the alternative is palliative medicine, you know, and an approach that emphasizes pain relief, symptom control, and spiritual and emotional care for the person who's dying as well as for their family.
And those who saw a palliative care specialist, says Gawande, stopped chemotherapy sooner, entered hospice far earlier, experienced less suffering at the end of their lives, and they lived 25% longer because they were dealing with the end of their life.
Right.
In other words, our decision-making in medicine has failed so spectacularly that we have reached the point of actively inflicting harm on patients, and this is the doctor talking, rather than confronting the subject of mortality. If end-of-life discussions were an experimental drug, the FDA would approve it. Right there.
Okay.
They're living 25% longer.
Yeah.
It seems to work better than any of the drugs. And the stories in this book are countless in terms of the things that people have agreed to end their lives. I mean, doctors want to help, and that's great. But they say, "We'll help you until you decide that you don't want to be helped any longer." But you're so busy dealing with the fallout of your, you know, with the impacts of your illness.
Right.
How are you going to know when it's time to stop? The doctor's job is to keep you alive and to cure you, and that's their goal. That's what they would like to do. I hope that medical schools are starting to talk about I know there are not enough doctors who have training in geriatric care, and that would be one of the issues, is end-of-life issues. And,
right.
And should always, and I'm sure it's a conversation that they have in their medical ethics classes. And as more states pass these laws, Now that the most populous state in the nation has passed it, I think, and I believe at least half the states have introduced bills like this one.
And how many states have actually passed the legislation?
I think California makes 6.
Okay, so I've got Maine, Hawaii, Maine in 2000, Hawaii in 2002. We're talking about death with dignity legislation. Washington State in 2008, Massachusetts in 2012, Vermont in 2013, California in 2015, and Montana sometime.
There's a couple. Montana's Supreme Court ruled physicians can prescribe medication, but there is not legislation.
Oh.
So that can come up, I suppose, if a patient's family wanted to sue the state and it ended up in court, they could get the court to say that this needs to be, that uh-huh. that doctor-assisted dying is legal in this state if somebody challenges it in court.
Yes.
And I believe that's happened in Alaska, but it hasn't been upheld by the court yet. It's been a long time.
Okay.
But this bill is a way to move forward and have these conversations.
And while I was doing my research, I think this is somewhat breaking news. The Canadian Supreme Court is considering a death with dignity law countrywide.
They've done it. They're done. So I suppose if you wanted to move to Canada, that's the closest place that we could go from Alaska.
All of Canada.
Supreme Court in Canada said that this is okay in Canada for any Canadian resident.
Well, that's very interesting mm-hmm. because it reminds me of the state-by-state approach that occurred with legalizing gay marriage
mm-hmm.
in
exactly.
the U.S. And
exactly.
so Quebec had legalized it. So they thought it was going to – when I read older material, obviously, it might have to go province by province. But it looks like they have a different system mm-hmm. or the Supreme Court mm-hmm. approved mm-hmm. Countrywide legalization.
Maybe somebody took it right to court after yeah. Quebec approved it and the Supreme said, hey – this is fine with us. You could
yeah.
let's just do it nationally while we're at it, same-sex marriage in the
yes.
United States.
Let's take a little break and hear a little music. We will be right back to continue our conversation about death with dignity legislation.
Okay.
Welcome back to Mind Over Matter. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and with me in the studio this evening are Representative Harriet Drummond and her legislative aide, Kristen Cranadoc. We're discussing legislation that Representative Drummond introduced allowing terminally ill patients to request a prescription from their doctor to end their life. And earlier in the show, we went through all the provisions, and it's very, very strict, as I can see, Harriet, leaving out people perhaps who have Parkinson's or dementia or ALS, where it's a long-term suffering. And so those people do not qualify unless they are within 6 months
right.
of dying.
Or you know, somebody who has a catastrophic accident or a burn, burns over how many percent of their body and they're mm-hmm. going to die. But they don't have time and they're not in this umbrella of patients that this bill addresses.
Mm-hmm.
But it opens the conversation to, medical directives that would cover patients like that, that know they're going to deteriorate to such a point that they don't want to be there.
Yes, yes. And what do you think of the situation that arose when President Obama was developing the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare, and he wanted to include that insurance would cover conversations at the end of life that patients could have with their doctor. And then at that point, our very own Sarah Palin entered the picture and called those death panels. I wonder if that went through and that it is covered, because as you know, spending 15 minutes with a doctor can be very, very expensive, and insurance companies may not cover those kinds of conversations, which of course over the long run would ease the suffering of human beings as well as reduce the costs.
That's right.
Care.
The conversations don't necessarily have to be with a doctor. They can be with a nurse or a specialist in psychiatry. We need to open up the conversation and start talking about it. As Dr. Gawande said, if end-of-life discussions were an experimental drug, the FDA would approve it because it seems to allow people to relax and begin to understand what they're going through rather than making rushed decisions about their treatment,
mm-hmm.
at the urging of a doctor who maybe not hasn't got any coursework in end-of-life care or geriatrics, for example. 97% of medical students take no courses in geriatrics. And the older we get, I think that we need to be addressing older folks in a more sensitive way and getting them prepared. None of us is going to leave this earth alive. We're all going to die.
You're lucky to be in Anchorage because you have a palliative care physician expert in Anchorage whose name I don't remember. Do you remember? Do you know who it is?
No, I don't. But is it the only one in the state?
I attended a workshop she gave,
mm-hmm.
and she's brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
And I do know that there are maybe one physician in Juneau who is trained in palliative care mm-hmm. or has an interest, maybe interest in palliative care. So it's a specialty
mm-hmm.
that too few physicians are trained in.
Right. Well, we have that problem in every sector of medicine in this state. But hospice and palliative care has got to be well developed. And if we find that it's not serving our Alaskans well, we need to improve that as well as provide people options.
Right. Some people have asked me, how can a physician actually predict if someone has 6 months to live? How does that work, do you know?
Not being a physician, I couldn't tell you, but they've got an oncologist, for example, and most of the people that have taken advantage of this legislation in Oregon have cancer. With thousands and thousands of cancer cases, they know that which types of cancer are treatable which types are not treatable, which types are going to result in certain death, and what it's like to die from this or that particular kind of cancer. And you have to count on their experience with these various types of cancers. The problem is you can do all sorts of heroic measures that will just make you suffer more, that may make you suffer more. They might help and they might not. In fact, I've introduced another bill called the Right to Try, that if a terminally ill patient knows that there is, or if their doctors know that there is an FDA drug trial ongoing mm-hmm. for their particular disease or condition
mm-hmm.
That has passed the first stage of FDA drug trials, which is determining that the drug is safe for human consumption, then they are allowed to step into the drug trial to take advantage of this drug instead of waiting for multiple months or years, which final approval of the drug often takes.
Now, is this about insurance coverage?
It's not about insurance coverage. It's about it's about terminally ill patients getting to participate in a drug trial that could cure them, even though they don't know for sure whether the drug will cure them yet. There's a number of cases that terminally ill patients wanted to try a drug, but they couldn't do it because they had to wait too long to get into stage two or stage three or whatever stage of trial the drug was in. And some months or years later, meanwhile, the terminally ill patient died, unable to use this drug. And months or years later, the drug was approved for their condition and was shown to help those conditions. So this is a number of states have also introduced this, and it allows terminally ill patients to bypass the waiting, because they don't have time to wait. But if they want to try the drug, why not? They're going to die anyway, so they may as well, you know, participate, and then that way the drug trials will have more data, and they could very well help this patient, since it's already been approved in the first stage that says, okay, now we can try this on human beings. So I sure would want that option if I had a terminal disease and I knew there was a drug trial, especially if it was the first kind of drug. I'd certainly volunteer to be a guinea pig.
Well, in the popular medical literature that I read, recall reading that some breakthrough discoveries have been made by physicians who are working with a terminally ill patient, and they have a hunch that a particular treatment might work, and they could only try it with a terminally ill patient. And if the patient, and there were some real cases of this where the patient not only approved but begged mm-hmm. for it, mm-hmm. and it. In that way, the discovery was made.
Mm-hmm. And they probably had to sign something that said, I understand that this drug could kill
sure.
me.
Absolutely.
But I'm going to die anyway because I have this disease
yeah.
or this condition. That's exactly what this Right to Try legislation would allow people to do. And in Alaska, we're so far from medical centers here.
Yeah.
In fact, when I was visiting my mother in December in California, she went to an eye specialist, a retina specialist, and it was determined she wasn't improving much. And they said, "Well, we can let you join this drug trial." When it turns out that she had to submit to having a needle stuck in her eye once a month, she said, "Hey, it's all right.
At my age, I don't need a needle."
That's right. At 92 and almost 93, yeah, I don't need that.
Well, back to predicting the six-month mark on how long one is going to live. I do recall that physicians have to do that all the time to have a patient be eligible for hospice care.
That's right. Not only hospice care, but doctors regularly help families make the decision of when to pull the plug on a comatose or seriously ill patient that isn't getting any better. And those folks who are on life support generally live a couple of days or maybe a couple of weeks at the most.
Mm-hmm.
So they know that those people are going to die unless they're continuing to be held on life support. And mm-hmm. you know, those things have been tested in the courts many times, and we know how that works. I had a close friend and neighbor who suffered a burst aneurysm in her brain at the age of roughly 50. And she never woke up again. It took her about 2 weeks in the hospital. It was awful. They had to drain her brain, all this stuff. She never came back. She never came back to consciousness. Her husband and her two small girls, her husband was out of town when it happened, and I was the only one who knew where he was. I had to call him and say, hey, you know, your wife has collapsed and she's in the hospital. Come home. And it took him a day or two to come back from wherever he was. I had charge of her children. Her brain was fried. You know, she was in intensive care for almost 2 weeks, and finally he made the decision, we're going to pull the plug. Mm-hmm. And to watch her was so grim. Her body tried to breathe. It was awful to watch, but it was going to happen. They knew that her body would eventually give up, but she was tough. I remember the when she was admitted, what, you know, at the emergency room, they didn't believe that she was the age that her identification said she were was. They thought she was a good 10 years younger physically. Mm-hmm. But I remember going to visit her on the night that she died, and I remember saying to her, I whispered to her and held her hand, and I said, you know, Deirdre, your girls are okay. Your husband is in charge. Everybody's okay. It's okay to let go. Mm-hmm. And I left and went home, and I understand about 20 minutes later she died.
Okay. Yeah, and so you've had that strong experience.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people have.
Uh-huh.
What kind of feedback have you been getting around this bill? What kind of what are your constituents and people around the state?
Very supportive.
So, you know what that makes me think? Makes me think ballot initiative, but also how it is that our elected representatives may be behind the curve from where people actually, what people are thinking.
That's right. Well, that's true in a lot of cases. And in this particular case, just the fact that there's all this public interest, that a number of states have passed this, and countries. We have, in Canada, it's been legal since last February. The United Kingdom is debating it now. It's legal in the Netherlands, in Belgium, in Switzerland, Germany, Albania, Colombia, Japan, and Luxembourg.
Really?
There's millions and tens of millions of people are eligible to do this. I'm sure people are still traveling to take advantage of it if they can. But again, I'm going to circle back to why I think this is important for Alaskans, is that nobody should have to travel to make a choice like this about the end of their lives. It's expensive to travel anyway, but to travel at the end of your life when things are incredibly uncomfortable, and you might have to travel to move into another hospital. Think of the expense and the agony and leaving your home, where you would much prefer to be at home, surrounded by loved ones, rather than in a strange place,
finding a new doctor. You have to. I mean, the complications. It could only be for the well-educated
and
the affluent.
Exactly. And the large majority of people who take advantage of this legislation are Caucasians, and they're well-educated. They're used to asking questions and challenging the institutions. And the other thing is, this legislation does not force doctors to participate. It does not force any medical professionals or institutions to participate.
Oh.
So, you know, it may be. Who knows? We haven't heard resistance from particular institutions because it hasn't infiltrated quite that far yet. But it's there will be physicians who will participate. And there will be those who don't. Nobody's requiring them to do it. It's simply a choice of the patients.
Yes. I just want to remind our listeners that this is Mind Over Matter. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and with me in the studio this evening is Representative Harriet Drummond and her aide, Kristen Cranendonk. We're having a discussion about the compelling issue of an individual's right to a physician-assisted death when they have a terminal illness. And are there any other thoughts that you or Kristen would like to share tonight because this is a topic that I think, if I know my friends and myself, people are really, really interested in. And here, Harriet, you've introduced the legislation. You have co-sponsors, I presume?
Yes.
Who are your co-sponsors?
Max Gruenberg and Andy Joseph, Representative Andy Josephson and Representative Max Gruenberg, both of whom are attorneys. And Max serves on the Judiciary Committee, which is the next committee of referral for this bill.
Uh-huh.
So if we can get it out of Hess soon and get it into Judiciary, we might see some results this year.
Is there a way to make it a bipartisan issue?
It will be. It will be as soon. Well, it is now because the Hess committee has two Democrats and five members of the majority.
So, do you feel that there would be a support among Republican legislators?
Oh yes, definitely.
Huh. Well, maybe this is something everybody could agree on.
I think it's something. Well, we don't need everybody. We just need 51% or 50% plus one of the legislators to agree on it. This is not a constitutional issue, which requires a larger vote or a ballot proposition or any of those things that require a higher percentage of a vote.
Okay. And
but then it also needs to go to the Senate and do the same thing. And the Senate is a little more conservative than the State House is right now.
Is there any way any of our listeners would be able to chime in on this? What could they do?
Absolutely. They could talk to their legislators. They could contact the members of the House Committee on Health and Social Services. They could talk to their own legislators. Here in Juneau, that would be Sam Keto and Dennis Egan and Kathy Munoz. And they can contact our office at 465-3875.
Would you repeat that?
907-465-3875.
Good. Well, we're going to wind up this evening. And I want to thank State Representative Harriet Drummond and her aide, Kristen Crandon-Donk, for coming to the K2 studio tonight and for their knowledgeable insights. And I'm going to include Kristen now, even though you haven't heard her voice, and I'll explain why, but their knowledgeable insights on Death with Dignity legislation. Kristen has been the power behind the throne here. She has been here working with some of the factual details that have come on this program tonight. So I want to thank both of you very much for coming. And also, John Kramer, thank you for taking time in your day. John is a volunteer, just as I am here at K2. And as I understand it, Kristen used to work at K2.
I sure did.
Yeah. Oh.
My office is across the hall.
Yeah. And now you've moved to Anchorage.
Yes, I moved to Anchorage to work for Representative Drummond.
And you get to be in Juneau for 90
plus days. I love coming back.
Days.
I mean, I'm a Juneau girl at heart, so.
That's right. And I love, if I have to be anywhere for a quarter of the year that's not at home, Juneau is a great place to be. I really enjoy being here. Juneau hosts the legislature beautifully. It's well set up for it. We've spent lots of time this last year, as you know, between special sessions and all of that stuff. And Juneau's a wonderful town, and I hope they'll help us get this bill out.
Thank you all in the studio and to our listeners. And join us again next month on a Monday evening from 7 to 8 p.m., and we'll have another edition of Mind Over Matter. Good night.